He's only probably one of maybe two or three directors I've ever worked with who you feel had the vision of the movie in his head before he started. He wasn't fishing when he started running film. He wasn't fishing. He was fulfilling a clear vision. And I mean, down to the frame, you felt sometimes. He had a great sense of rhythm, of pace, and he knew exactly what he wanted.
Since they shot me and the government...
Hey, I was there too, all right? You remember? You don't see me running around pissing off everybody we're trying to get to help us.
Yeah, well, you can walk. And I'm in this chair. And I got money, okay? I got money, and that gives me the power to shake up this system, Dougie.
Well, find somebody else to help you then. Because this is not what I signed on for. I don't even know what we're engaged in anymore, Larry. If you get on that plane, I quit.
Alan, don't be so melodramatic. You don't want to quit me. I'm your dream client. I'm the most fun, I'm rich, and I'm always in trouble.
I think Milos's uniqueness is that he has passion, complete passion and dedication to his work. He takes full responsibility for what he chooses, yet he's very demanding in getting what he wants, and he doesn't compromise his vision. He truly is an artist, and I respect that.
I had a very peculiar introduction into the movies. I think I was like 5 years old or 6 years old when my parents took me for the first time in the movie. And this was 1938. And they took me to see a silent version of the most popular Czech opera, Barton Bride. And, well, first of all, I was absolutely mesmerized suddenly to sit, you know, with a lot of people and everybody. In those times, some people even put on ties to go to the movies, you know. And then the lights go down and screen lights up. And there is this orchestra playing overture, but you couldn't hear a thing. And then the curtain goes up on the screen, and there is this choir, this chorus, in the Czech national costumes, and they start to sing. And in that moment, something which was amazing happened. The people in the theater started to sing along. Because this opera is so popular, it's Barton Bride, it's the most popular Czech opera. And in that moment, it was sort of perceived by the audience as a kind of a almost patriotic kind of event, you know, to protect national culture against this invasion of the, you know, Nazis and like that. And I thought, this is it. This is it. Making movies is great. You make a movie, then you go sit in the theater and sing.
Yes! All right! Bravo! Perfect! Beautiful!
Throughout his life and work, Milos Forman has assimilated and combined the best of European and American cinemas. In a career which includes auteur films and spectacular productions, Milos Forman is perhaps the only filmmaker to be considered as international, at least one of the very few to escape any kind of definition by genre or nationality. The youngest of three sons, Forman was born in 1932 in Kaslov, Czechoslovakia. When he was 9 years old, both parents were arrested by the Gestapo and perished in the death camps. Forman got the theater bug in 1945 while attending a boarding school founded mostly for children, like himself, who were left parentless by the war. Eventually, he enrolled in the University of Prague's Film Institute. After graduating from the academy in 1955, Forman began writing screenplays and worked for a while as an assistant director for a theater group. In 1963, he launched into his first feature film, Black Pepper, an autobiographical account of a teenager in a small Czech town. Black Pepper became a hit at film festivals in Cannes, Montreal, and New York. But it wasn't until 1965 that he began to make his mark on the international scene with the release of Loves of a Blonde. It was Forman's keen observation and imagination that brought the film to life.
I was going back home like 2 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly I see a single girl walking with a suitcase. And, you know, just by the walk, a single woman at 2 o'clock in the... Because the way woman, single woman walks in the middle of night, you can say approximately what kind of woman it is. So I started to talk to her. And I found out that she came to Prague invited by a guy who seduced her in the town where she lived and gave her... She gave herself to him, you know, because he promised her, you know, I'll invite you to Prague and, you know, we'll be together and whatever, and gave her his address. And when she came to Prague, that address didn't exist, you know. So she was waiting for the last, for the first train in the morning to go back home, because it was kind of, you know, apolitical comedy. And it went through the censorship and they allowed me to do the movie.
After the positive reception of Loves of a Blonde, Forman and a couple of other Czech filmmakers began working on another script, but found themselves distracted by the hustle and bustle of Prague. So they went off to a small nearby town in the mountains to write. One day, while attending a local fireman's ball, they got the idea to write a good-natured lampoon of the nation's firefighting bureaucracy. That film, titled Fireman's Ball, so unsettled state functionaries that the film was banned in Czechoslovakia.
I'm Miloš Forman, and I'm the director of this film which you are going to see now. This film is about firemen and was released in my country, in Czechoslovakia, even before the Dubček leadership. The release of this film was followed by rather strange reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned as a protest against the film. So we had to meet the firemen organization. We spent several hours talking, trying to explain that this film, in fact, is not about firemen, that the firemen are symbols about the whole society. Finally, this explanation made the firemen happy and peaceful. But the silly truth is that this film, in fact, is about firemen. And please don't look for hidden symbols and double meanings. All what I wanted making this film was you to have a good time. Thank you.
I was told that it was shown even to the first secretary of the party and the president of the country then, and I was told that when he saw the film that he climbed the wall. The fact is that the film was immediately officially banned forever. That word was there, banned forever. Carlo Ponti got involved in this film, and I thought, that's a smart move, that will protect me, you know. Well, I think Carlo Ponti hated the film even more than the Czech censors and refused to and asked, as a matter of fact, for his money back. And it was not a funny situation, because I got an official letter that I will be charged with the sabotaging the socialist economy, and that carried a sentence of 10 years in prison. But fortunately, I had a chance to smuggle the film and show it to François Truffaut and Claude Berry in Paris. And they reimbursed Carlo Ponti, and that got me off the hook. And they bought the rights for the film worldwide.
When the Soviet tanks rumbled into Prague in August of 1968, Forman was in Paris negotiating to make his first American film, Taking Off. He returned to Prague briefly in 1969 before moving to New York to work on the script. According to the Czech government, he was illegally out of the country and was fired from his job at the studio, forcing him to remain in the United States. Initially, Forman was refused a green card to work in the U.S. American immigration claimed he had lied on his application about being a member of the Communist Party.
Bunk Henry, who a friend of mine who was a star of Taking Off, learned about it, and he talked to a few people. He talked to Mike Nichols, he talked to Paddy Chayefsky, and they wrote a letter, you know, asking the immigration office to reconsider and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. The irony is that they extended my visa, that after a few weeks they called me back to the immigration office, and the officer was very funny. He was telling me, Mr. Forman, I'm happy to tell you that you were never a member of Communist Party.
Forman got the idea for his 1971 release, Taking Off, from the then-active protest movement among the young, with its proliferation of marijuana, folk singing, psychedelic happenings, and adolescent runaways in revolt against their square parents. The film starring Buck Henry was a critical triumph and a box office disaster. It won the grand prize of the jury at the Cannes Film Festival in a tie with Johnny Got His Gun.
You know, Taking Off is like this secret little nugget that's passed between friends and admirers. Where is it? How can I see this movie again? And except for the odd festival and the odd tape that exists, you can't. And in fact, Taking Off was not a particularly successful film in the United States, in spite of the fact that it had incredibly vocal adherence and critical nods. It just couldn't find an audience.
Taught me a lesson in humility, because I thought I made a masterpiece. And the first critics were pretty good. I was even more sure that I'm a world champion now. And the film opened and closed right away.
It seems to me he kind of scores life in some way when he watches it, when he sees it. So that there's a kind of operatic character to his films that give them a sort of relentless dynamism that isn't often apparent in a script or in a publicity release.
A bleak period followed Taking Off, with film deals that fell through and a play directed by Forman that failed on Broadway, as well as the difficulties of learning a new language and adjusting to a new country. Forman ended up in the Chelsea Hotel in Greenwich Village in New York, sleeping 23 hours a day. He was close to a nervous collapse in 1973 when he got a package from Michael Douglas and Saul Zentz containing a copy of Ken Kesey's hit novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But that was only the end of a series of bizarre coincidences that would lead to Forman directing the movie and winning his first Academy Award and the Directors Guild of America Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Motion Pictures. It all began to unfold years earlier when actor Kirk Douglas closed in the Broadway version of Cuckoo's Nest.
And suddenly Kirk Douglas had nothing to do for a while. And he was asked by then dead already President Kennedy to go on the Goodwill tour in Eastern European countries, or, you know, communist countries. So he said, okay, I have time, I'll go there. He came to Prague. There was a small party in the apartment of the cultural attaché, and there Kirk Douglas, whom they showed some films, I guess a film of mine at the studio, asked me if he can send me a book, if I would read it and tell him if I would be interested to come to America and make a movie. Book never came, so of course, you know, I assumed the moment he left the room he forgot, you know, just made the head spin to this young, naive Czech filmmaker, right? And now this is the same book sent to me by Michael Douglas and Saul Zentz. Well, later, Kirk told me when I met Kirk, said, "You son of a gun, you know, you remember many years ago I sent you a book and you even didn't have a courtesy to say go and shove it." I said, "Well, the same thing I thought about you." Because what happened was, he really sent the book, but censors, you know, they were opening mails from America in that times, you know, found the book, they confiscated the book, but didn't tell this neither to Kirk nor to me. And suddenly, this book is coming, you know, 10 years later or whatever, when I'm in the Chelsea Hotel. And I found out that Michael Douglas and Saul Zenz didn't know. Michael didn't know that his father was already sending it to me before. It was some kind of an omen, almost.
You let me go on hassling Nurse Ratched here, knowing how much I had to lose, and you never told me nothing.
Now, Mac, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I didn't know anything about how much... Wait a minute. Now, listen. Now, look, I'm voluntary here. See, I'm not committed. I don't have to stay here. I mean, I can go home anytime I want.
You can go home anytime you want.
That's it.
You're bullshitting me.
No.
He's bullshitting me, right?
No, Randall. He's telling you the truth. As a matter of fact, there are very few men here who are committed. There's Mr. Bromden, Mr. Tabor, some of the chronics, and you.
We've never met each other, but he put the script down. He opened to page one, and he began step by step telling us how he saw the movie and how he would do it. And we finally realized that we were not crazy, Saul and I, that this is the way to work, and that he realized the love and affection we had for this project, and he wanted to share with us how he was going to do it. And that first meeting and what he had to say is really what won us over.
I realized that this is a story about a man from the world known to us entering a world totally unknown to us, the mental institution. So I thought it's proper that the man who represents me, who comes from my world, should be a star, somebody who is known, whom I can identify with. But everybody else in that institution shouldn't be known faces. It should be all, you know, unknowns who really you can take for guys who have problems. And I auditioned over 1,000 actors for this ward, you know, of loonies.
Richardson and Browning first, he's going for second. The ball's in the deep right center. Davidson over in the corner, cut the ball off. Here comes the throw, Richardson around, and Gertz, he goes to the second. He's dodging in there, he's staying. It's a double, he's in there, Martin. You look at Richardson, he's on second base. Kovac is in big fucking trouble. Big trouble, baby. All right, here's Kresh, the next batter. Kresh looks in, Kovac. Kovac gets a sign from Roseboro. He kicks once, he pumps, he fires. It's a strike. Kovac's curveball is stabbing off like a fucking firecracker. All right, here he comes for the next pitch. Kresh swings. It's a lot of fly ball, and he flips it.
From the first day, and these guys were into it. And so we rehearsed that morning, and then we broke for lunch in the cafeteria right on this ward of the mental hospital. And, you know, so I was our star, and I saw Jack kind of looking around and this and that. And he pushed his tray away, and he went outside, and I went after them. After him, I said, "Jack, what is it?" He said, "Who are these guys? These guys actors?" They really said, yeah, they're all... And that was the kind of a commitment that you felt you could see in rehearsal. And from the first day, they were locked. They were into it. And Milos was a conductor. You know, he really played the group like a symphony and had such a clear picture in his mind of exactly what he wanted.
Now, calm down. The best thing we can do is go on with our daily routine. All right?
Mr. Oh. Max!
When the moon is in the sky and Jupiter and with the Mars, then peace will guide the planet and love will steer the
1979, Foreman released Hair, the popular historic rock hippie Broadway musical. Once more, the reviewers raved, but the box office fizzled. Yet it was a film that Foreman wanted to make from the time he first came to America.
Hair was, one of these, I guess, destiny projects. Because when I was in New York in 1967, I was visiting and I saw the very first public preview of Broadway of Hair. I didn't understand a word, but I loved the songs. I just went crazy about the melodies.
Big hair with hair, long beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen. Give me down to there, half shoulder length or longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair.
Show it, long as God can do it.
I love musicals, but you can't repeat the musicals from the 30s or 40s, and I just how to establish a style of a musical, that it's, because it drive me crazy, to imagine that somebody walks normally like do and suddenly, starts to sing. It's, it's just so unreal, and it's so arbitrary. It's like... in that case, it's better to photograph the stage rather to try to make the film. So that was the main challenge, it's how to establish right at the beginning, painlessly, that these people will be not only talking, but also singing.
Claude here is in love, and the girl he's in love with is sitting right here in this room. He just wants to sit here, and he just wants to look at her for about 5 minutes. I mean, because he wants to just look at her and just maybe, like, have his picture in his head when he's off there fighting in the jungles. So is that so much to ask? I mean, hey, this is for you, man. Now, wait a minute. This is what you want. So, Sheila, is that okay with you? Is it okay if Claude just sits here and looks at you for a few minutes before we go?
You've got a hell of a nerve, young man.
I got life, mother. I got life, sister. I got freedom, brother.
My casting was a very, very long, tedious process. The musical, instead of having one person decide the director, we had a director. We had Jerry Ragney and Jim Rado, who wrote it. Twyla Tharp choreographed it. Galt McDernot wrote the music. So I was, I had to please all of those different people. So I auditioned for the film 12 times over a period of about 3.5 months.
He was a great singer. He was great, good looking, very good dancer, good actor, but the others were too. And he suddenly, so we were really testing again and again and again, until suddenly one day he just exploded and took off his pants and mooned the Jerry and Jimmy, Rado and Ragney, and started to yell at them that they can go, and just put back off his pants and left. Silly enough, that told me, yes, that's him. That's Berger.
He had a wonderfully, what I would call, European way of directing. Milos would just shoot the hell out of a scene. He would do anywhere from 6 to 15 takes. And I always thought that what he was doing was waiting us out. In effect, he was waiting for us to kind of stop doing what we thought we should be doing as actors. The ideas we had in our heads. And to start behaving naturally. And then once the natural behavior began, we got bored with this idea of how the scene should go, the scene would actually become more and more alive. And I always thought, too, he'll tell you this, sir, that he might be waiting for one moment in a scene, but he'd do the whole scene. But it might be one section that he didn't think was quite right.
The good thing about it is when you finish shooting with Milos, you have the movie. I mean, you have it every possible ways. Because he writes one movie, he shoots another, but he makes his movies in the editing room. And never have we ever had to go back. Sometimes I complain about the amount of footage we have, but then he'll make me sit down and say, look, see that shot you didn't think we need? It's in here. So I completely trust him artistically.
Forman's next film was Ragtime, which was adapted from E.L. Doctorow's complex and panoramic novel of the same name. The film takes place in 1930s New York and revolves around a black piano player portrayed by Howard E. Rollins, Jr., who has won fame and fortune playing with a jazz band. With Ragtime, Forman demonstrated his sure touch and empathy for American themes.
You have a lot of material you read, which are all right, which are even very well written and good, but there is always has to be some hook which just grabs you, you know, like in Harry it was the songs, you know. In The Cuckoo's Nest, basically, besides everything else, it was that whole ending, because that was my, you know, situation in Czechoslovakia, that when you lived in the communist country, you just wanted to grab that big thing and throw it through the bars in the window and run away, you know. In Ragtime, it was that scene when Kohlhaas Walker has his Model T and finds a shit on its seat. And now he faces this dilemma. To clean it with his own hands or to ask for justice that those who did it should clean it. Because that was, again, such a reverb from my life in totalitarian regime, where so often you are humiliated by scraping out the shit of somebody else.
I want this cleaned up.
Oh, I don't blame you. Hell of a shame. Brand new car like that.
I want it cleaned up.
Go ahead. Clean it up.
I can't, Willie. Nobody's laughing. Now, what the hell do you boys think you're up to?
I'll tell you exactly what happened, Frankie. You see a fancy nigger park right smack in front of the firehouse. Now, if you don't think that's a serious business, tell me about it when your house is burning, we can't get the pump out, and the road's all blocked because the nigger's car.
I had no intention of stopping in front of the firehouse, but my way was blocked. I don't know why you did this. I never caused you any harm.
Another series of unexpected circumstances would bring Forman into contact with legendary actor James Cagney.
I met him socially at some dinner, and he invited me to visit him at his house, and I go there like 3 weeks later. He already forgot who I am, and he asked me, well, who are you? Well, I make films, so is there a film I might have seen? I thought my latest film is Hair. And he looked at me and said, oh, now I know. And I must say first that you wouldn't find in his house any memorabilia of his movies. No posters, nothing. He just hated it. He didn't like it. And he goes to the cupboard and he's bringing me something and he's saying, I never saw it. I never had a desire to see it. I don't know how this got here. I don't know why I kept it here until now. It's yours. And he gave me a poster of the first off-Broadway preview of Hair. That's the one I attended like 10 years before. You know, I couldn't believe that.
After a self-imposed 20-year hiatus from films, Cagney would eventually agree to appear in Ragtime. It would prove to be Cagney's last theatrical movie performance.
He told me, but I'm not signing anything. You pay me scale, I don't want any money, and I'm not making decision until day before shooting. If you accept these conditions, go ahead, I'll do it. How can I tell producer, you know? Well, I had to tell him that he will not sign anything, but I didn't tell Dino that day before the shooting, James might change his mind. And it was so touching because the first scene we shot is when Commissioner addresses, like, I don't know, 150 Pinkertons. And when James entered the set, they all started to applaud. And they were applauding, and James was standing there, tears coming down his cheeks.
And people keep telling me, you're a worthless piece of slime.
Hold him! You can't talk to me like that!
Shut up, Willie. You're going to help us now. You're going to talk to that troublemaker, and I mean talk hard like you never talked before. Because he wants you, Willie. And if you can't make him change his demands, he's going to get you.
He was absolutely amazing. First of all, he gave me the best hope for the old age. Because with his age, everything deteriorated. Everything. He couldn't. It's all cue cards. He couldn't remember one line. He was in constant pain. Nothing worked. Except one thing which didn't deteriorate at all, and that's the talent. Because he's there on the set, her cue cards prepared. He's sitting there. He's looking like anytime he. At the best, you'll fall asleep. When I say action, here he was. Sparkles in his eyes. Perfect, perfect, you know. When I say cut, again here he is. You know, sitting like that. Now, I turn the camera on the other actor. And I tell James, you can go in your trailer now and rest. And I'll do your lines for the other actor. And James said, oh, it's better if I'll do. It's better if I'll do it for him. It's better. Always. It's amazing, man. Amazing, man.
In 1984, Forman teamed up once again with Cuckoo's Nest producer Saul Zantz to make Amadeus. Filmed on a grand scale, Amadeus enjoyed both critical and commercial success and won for Forman his second Academy Award as Best Director, as well as his second Directors Guild of America Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Motion Pictures.
That was Mozart.
When I was preparing Ragtime, I was in London casting for a few days only. And I'm in my hotel room with three or four actors. Telephone rings. Mr. Lantz, my representative, calls if I want to join him and go in the evening to see a theater. And I was busy there, so without even asking what, I told him, yeah, sure, I'll go with you. Only in a taxi, I learned that we are going to see some play about Mozart. And I said, oh my God. Probably if I asked him before, I would excuse myself because, you know, in, again, difficult to explain these things. During the communist time in Czechoslovakia, we were flooded with Russian, Czech, Polish, Hungarian films about composers. Why? Because composer doesn't talk. He doesn't say anything subversive. It's his music. And music is not ideologically offensive, you know. So they love to make films. And they were all the most boring films I ever saw. So I was prepared for a very boring evening. And I couldn't believe what I see. And in the intermission, I turned to Robbie Lantz and I said, well, listen, if this play goes like this till the end, that could be a wonderful movie.
It was clear to me. That sound I had heard in the Archbishop's palace had been no accident. Here again was the very voice of God. I was staring through the cage. Those meticulous ink strokes had an absolute beauty.
There was no major studio which would finance at the beginning Amadeus at all. And the first thing they were interested in, you know, who would be starring in it. Now, I was doing very extensive search, you know, interviews and readings with actors for all the parts. And I read F. Murray Abraham for the small role of this Rosenberg, the director of the opera. And I was calling him back to help me read up other actors for other parts, even for Salieri. He would be reading Rosenberg, somebody else would be reading Salieri. Finally, I asked him one day, had an actor there for Mozart, I said, if he would just help me to read Salieri. He was brilliant. He was brilliant as Salieri, helping me read a guy for Mozart. And I told him, F. Murray, I am really thinking, you know, to give you the part. So please, but give me a week, no more, to confirm it, you know, to give you an offer, to give you an offer. Obviously, he didn't believe me, because when a week later we gave him an offer, he already accepted another movie. So what we had to do is to change a little bit our schedule to accommodate that he can finish what he was doing.
The thing about Milos is that he approaches each actor quite individually. There was a thing he said to Roy Dotrice, which I just loved one day. He said, Roy, you're too much acting, too much. Too much. And so he did another take. He says, no, now you are acting, not acting. His approach to me was quite different. He said, we don't want you to do a mediocrity. We want you to think of this as you did when you played Cyrano and when you played Iago. Cyrano's romanticism and Iago's manipulation. And that's what really is the support for that part. If you were to approach this man, or any character you play, as a loser, I think you'd be sunk. No one would care. And Milos knew that. And he kept me afloat by reminding me of the huge parts I had done on stage. And that was, I thought, a key.
The restored third act was bold, brilliant. The fourth was astounding.
There are some people who suggest that the Academy Award is a curse. Well, you can curse me as many times as you like. You know, to all those people who say that the Academy Award is a curse, I say one thing. It's the best thing that ever happened to my career. Absolutely.
Forman's retelling of the Chaudelot Delaclos novel, Dangerous Liaisons, was released in 1989 to critical success, but box office indifference. Forman's meticulous retelling of the story was titled Valmont, after the main character played by actor Colin Firth. Set in Baroque France, a scheming widow and her lover wage a bet regarding the corruption of a soon-to-be-married young woman.
Madame, is it true that I'm getting married?
Who told you that?
Everybody's been talking about it.
Well, I'm not supposed to say anything. But yes, it's true.
To whom? To whom?
I can't say.
Please, madame, please.
I mean, I don't know. Your mother's been so secretive about it.
Oh, but can you try and find out?
He became very notorious among all of us as being fairly exacting and demanding. And one of the techniques that Milos would use to get us to do something is, let's say my line was, more wine, please. So we would start the rehearsal and I would say, more wine, please. And he would say, no, 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 you don't say, more wine, please. He imitates you, doing it so badly that you think, oh my God, that was horrendous. And then he says, no, 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 natural, natural. So as the further we got into it, the more I would begin to say, well, just show me. Just show me what you mean. Just do it for me. Because it was usually a story that a story point that he would be trying to get me to illustrate by acting out a certain moment. And he was always right.
You know, little Cecile, she reminds me so much of myself when I was 15. She's naive, innocent, pure.
Yes.
I want you to put an end to it. I want you to take her virginity. I want Jacour to discover on this wedding night that he didn't get there first. I want to make him the laughing stock of Paris.
Annette Bening was such a revelation for me. I saw her on the stage here in New York, and she was amazing. I was reading a lot of young ladies for that part, and she just came in the room. At Norton was the same experience. Right there, if I had that on the film, it's perfect. How she hit it, right on.
For those of you that don't know, Belmont was an international flop, and Milos handled it with such grace and with such class, and I will always thank him for that, because I learned a great lesson from him. He never blamed anybody. He never blamed the movie company. Like some people do, if a movie doesn't do well, they say, oh, well, it wasn't marketed right. He didn't blame the critics who didn't write about it in the way that he wanted them to, or anything else. I never saw him deal with it, but in the most touching way. It was just deeply, deeply disappointing. And I really will always appreciate that, because it was a great lesson to me.
You know, George Orwell said that if liberty means anything, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. Now, America is the strongest country in the world today only because it is the freest country. And if it ever loses sight of its basic heritage and the principles involved, then we will no longer be free.
Foreman's 1996 release of The People vs. Larry Flynt proved to be an important movie, one that affected everyone's First Amendment rights. Larry Flynt was a man everyone knew of, a sometimes loathsome individual devoid of morals who fought the system and won a victory for the human spirit. However, when first presented with the script for the project, Foreman rejected it out of hand, thinking that perhaps it was about pornography. Initially, he refused to read it at all.
Robbie Lance calls me, Milos, you should read it as a courtesy to Oliver Stone. So what do you mean, Oliver Stone? Because that was only name of the production company producing. It was not Oliver's name. That's Oliver Stone producing dirty movie. Well, okay. I respect Oliver very much, so I'll read it out of courtesy. I read it and I loved it. It was a wonderful script already, what I read, And I realized that it has nothing to do with pornography. It's a film about something else, totally something else. It's much more important than pornography. I said, well, I want to meet this Mr. Flynt. So I'm meeting Mr. Flynt, and here's the script in front of him. I said, I have a few notes here for you. I said, well, Larry, there are very, very, embarrassing or unflattering things about you. You don't mind, I hope. And he said, of course I do mind. I do mind very much, but they are truth. So what can I do? That's an attitude, So, Larry, you want to be in the film? I want to be in the film. No, I want you to play the judge who sentenced you to 25 years in prison. Oh, yeah, that I can do.
Your Honor, with the court's permission, at this time, the defense would like to introduce into evidence 27 other men's magazines sold in the Cincinnati area. Titles such as Penthouse, Playboy,
Objection.
Three.
Sustained.
Sustained? Wait a second, Your Honor, if I may. These magazines contain material that is virtually identical to Hustler magazine. If these magazines are legal and Hustler is not legal, then this is clearly a case of selective prosecution.
No.
I'm sorry, did you say no?
I will not allow them into evidence. They're irrelevant to this case.
But they are not irrelevant. They are not irrelevant. They very clearly demonstrate the community standard, which is laid out...
No, Counselor. The jury is representative of community standards, not a pile of magazines. I won't admit them.
You won't admit them.
This is a film basically about how important our freedoms are. The real hero of this movie is the Supreme Court of the United States. The most difficult aspect of this film was what happened after the film was released, when the film was attacked by the feminists, namely Gloria Steinem, for glorifying pornography. It was sad, because this film is glorifying pornography as much as Romeo and Juliet is glorifying teenage suicide. I lived long enough where the freedom of speech was curtailed, extinguished, basically. And I know what it means. I am all personally convinced that if Hitler didn't succeed to muzzle the press, the free press, he would be overthrown. He wouldn't be able to carry out the World War II.
Well, sir, tell me, are you here now to obey the court's order and reveal the source of that videotape, or are you going to pay the $10,000 that I ordered?
Your Honor, I'd like a moment with my client.
I don't need a moment. It is my right, under the freedom of the First Amendment, to protect my sources.
Listen. Don't think of
anything. Hey.
Let me talk.
Shut up. Relax, Alan. Relax.
He involved me in the casting for all these different parts, like the part that was ultimately Ed Norton's and, of course, Courtney's part. You know, I'd come in and I'd read, and I think in that way he really helped me to find the character because, you know, over the course of that year or 9 months or whatever it was before we actually started filming, I'd performed this character in so many different ways before trying to adopt an accent or any kind of little mannerisms. You know, I'd just been getting around the words and the way he talked and the way he thought in a way that finally, when we finally started shooting, you know, I was so much closer to the character.
Hello.
It's Alan. They just brought the decision in.
Well, is it good or bad?
Well, it's a unanimous decision, Larry, and Rehnquist wrote it himself.
Is it good or bad?
Yeah, I want you to hear this. At the heart of the First Amendment is the recognition of the fundamental importance of the free flow of ideas. Freedom to speak one's mind is not only an aspect of individual liberty, but essential to the quest for truth and the vitality of society as a whole. In the world of debate about public affairs, many things done with motives that are less than admirable are nonetheless protected by the First Amendment.
So we won.
Yes, we did. We won.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
I'll mention it.
One time, Milos wanted me to come on the set, and I was just going to shoot an over, you know, which means over the shoulder. Might catch a little bit of the face, or at least that's what I was thinking. So I'm so lazy that I just shaved this side of my face, you know, just wanted to shave half my face. And I go on the set half shaven, but I just wanted to get it done and get in there, you know, so I didn't bother with the other side of the face. Anyway, so I come, and of course it turns out he's going to see everything, and it's not just an over.
Well, you said this take is over my shoulder to the other person. Yeah, but are you going to talk to him like that so that I can see your cheek? So he had to go back to the makeup room. I'm ready to collapse in this kind of tension. And Michael Hausmann said, come, I'll show you something. Now we drive like 1 or 3, 4 miles there, we're in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of fields, shack and fences, and there are dogs running there. And we go there, and there is this mommy bloodhound with like 7 2-day-old puppies.
Buck took the puppy and named him Woody Krutosh. Woody after me. And Krutosh knows, who knows what that means in Czech. And so to this day, he has Woody Krutosh and loves that little puppy, but he always gave me credit for, you know, having got that dog.
Hello, I am Andy.
I want to be the biggest star in the world.
Your act is like amateur hour.
And I'm not like everybody else.
I really like what you did out there.
I'm not a comedian. I don't want to go for cheap laughs.
What's wrong with this guy?
They detest you. That means we're a success.
Man on the Moon, released in 1999, was a biographical film about the late comedian Andy Kaufman and starred actor Jim Carrey. Foreman had seen Kaufman perform on stage as far back as the mid-70s and was intrigued by the comedian's style and unusual offbeat sense of humor.
I think it was 1975 or 1976, Bug Henry took me to improv in Los Angeles. There's some new guys there. So we go there, and there is this kid comes on the stage, is carrying a small book, and says, I'm going to read you a short story which is about this and this. And for 10 minutes, he's telling you what the short story is about. And then he opens the book and starts to read the short story. We were described every detail of that story. And the first 5 minutes, and he started to read it, I really felt sorry for him. I really felt like, oh my God, this guy is thinking it's funny. 5 minutes later, not me, oh, everybody, most of us were laughing, crawling on the floor laughing. And I didn't know why. But that was Andy Kaufman. Every time then, since then, I heard about him. I just became fascinated. And a few years ago, it was the Michael Douglas, he's in my life. I think it was his 50th birthday party. And Danny DeVito was there. And Danny, you know, I knew him, and I loved him. And here he is today. He has a production company. He knows Andy Kaufman. So I go to him and says, Danny, I'd like to make a movie about Andy Kaufman. And he got enthusiastic. And that was it.
Well, I thought I was going to be a lot more involved in the picture. I was only there for a couple of days myself. But, of course, Andy was there. And Tony Clifton was there. And so I don't really know a lot about Miloš Forman, except what I hear.
I can sincerely say that during the shooting of Man on the Moon, I met Jim Carrey only twice. And that was 2 Saturdays when we had dinner. Otherwise, every day I met either Andy Kaufman or Tony Clifton or Elvis Presley or Latka.
The interesting thing that I heard about the way Miloš was working was that at first he was a little annoyed that, you know, that he wasn't dealing with me, which I guess he thought he was going to be dealing a lot more with me when he first took the project on.
And I don't think that he did it, that he transformed himself into the character the moment he stepped out of the car. I think he woke up that character that morning already.
After the first 2 weeks, you know, the first week he would come to me, he'd call me at home and he'd say, I'm tired. I'm so tired. You know, I don't know how to handle Tony.
You are a complicated person.
You don't know the real me.
There isn't a real you.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
I don't know, and I don't want to know how actors work. All I told him, you know, Jim, instead of half an hour every day in the gym, watch the tapes of Andy.
You couldn't get further out than what was done on this project, and he was really the first one to join forces with me and with Tony and with Andy on it and go, you know what? I don't know how to handle it yet, but I certainly would never tell you to stop. He's a big artist rights person. person. He believes in the artist. He believes in that these expressions and these choices happen for a reason. He appreciated the fact that it was different than anything either of us had ever done. And what better place for an artist to live?
Now, Andy, did you hear about this one?
I love getting to a point where you don't think about the material anymore and it's above the material. That's great when that happens, you know. But oftentimes, I mean, there were many times when I would go to Milos and say, I think Andy screwed it up. And Milos would sit there and go, no, it's perfect. It's perfect. Like that. And, you know, I'd get all upset and I knew that I could do better.
You're insane.
But you might also be brilliant.
And of course I would go and I would do it and I'd do it 10 more times and then ultimately look back and realize that he was right and that he had what he needed and he knew what he wanted.
It's very hard to intrude on somebody else's vision, but it seems to me that that Foreman sees things aesthetically from some rather oddly different standpoints than the average director. He sees it, even if it's not operatic, he sees it as music.
Milos is the kind of director who sits next to the camera and you feel his presence and you feel him. He kind of is acting it. He's acting the whole thing out as the scene's going on. He's kind of making the same faces as all the actors are making, and he's, you know, emotionally feeling through every moment. So he's incredibly invested in the process.
When I'm making a movie, my ambition is really to be appreciated by a handful of friends. I would like in 20 years, if they look at my films and say, not bad. The highlight when I realized that I made it was I never got so many phone calls, neither after receiving an Oscar or, I don't know, whatever, as I did when my name appeared in New York Times crossword puzzle. Then I realized people calling me from everywhere that I made it.